from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In a special newscast today, we spend our time speaking with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, about news and events throughout the Latin America and Caribbean region. Tony, welcome.
Thanks a million, Don. And there's loads going on as usual.
Yeah.
It's always difficult to know where to start.
Let's see. Pick it up wherever you like. We'll get there.
Well, here in Nicaragua, where I live, there's a lot of concern about volcanic activity here. So far, it's been within the normal range of activity, but there's a volcano called Talica, which is kind of half. I think it's halfway between León and Chinandega in the northwest of the country, and that's showing a lot of explosive activity, throwing gas and volcanic material up into the air. About the last explosion threw stuff up 500 meters into the air.
Is that part of the same Pacific Ridge chain like that the Chile volcano sits on? Is that related?
No, I'm not a geologist, but it's on certainly on that side of the coast, and there's a chain of volcanoes that runs up through Central America that runs up in a similar line. So yeah, it may well be, and that's. It's all part of the people here, anyway, see it as all part of the climate change process and the adaptation of the planet to new climatic conditions. And who knows who's right or wrong about all that? But the nitty gritty. And so far, it hasn't affected aviation. In other countries, when volcanoes explode like that, it often affects some. The flights of civilian airlines coming and leaving from the country, but so far there's been no announcement to that effect in Nicaragua.
Mm, that's good. Yeah, of course that can happen.
That's a big deal. And in politics here in Nicaragua, we just saw the end of the current session of the UN Committee on Decolonization. And they discussed a whole range of issues, including the Malvinas and the situation of. And I think they did discuss the situation of Puerto Rico. They certainly discussed the situation of the Western Sahara and other areas in the world that are still under colonial control.
Yeah.
The general consensus was that the process of decolonization that began way back at the end of the Second World War still is taking far too long to complete, and the few remaining territories that remain colonies should receive more attention so that they finally gain their independence.
Yeah, Daniel Ortega moved forward to the front of the media attention on the conference. What was it, CELAC? I forget which conference. Earlier this year, when he allowed Puerto Rican nationalists to speak in his place.
Yeah. So, and that's. It was, I just thought it was interesting that session was held here in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And it was addressed by the former president of the General Assembly, Padre Miguel Descoto, who made his traditional his long-standing criticisms of the United Nations and its inability to deliver on fundamental things like decolonization.
You know, it's interesting because in Africa this past week also there was a conference of, I don't remember if it was just regional or if it was the entire AU, but they were focused on, seriously focused on reforming the Security Council dramatically and spreading the veto power around by continent.
Right. Yeah, and that's quite a long-standing demand, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Let's hope that those kinds of reforms happen at some point, despite the bitter resistance of the United States and its allies.
Yeah.
I'm here in the region. What else has been going on? There's a very serious corruption scandal in Guatemala that's kind of spilled over into Honduras to some extent. And in Guatemala, there's been a total, I'm just looking at the list, there's been a total of 10 government functionaries, including three ministers and a vice minister, who had to resign as a result of corruption allegations. And including the vice president and the minister of the interior, and I don't know what the equivalent is in the United States, but and that's quite a very important ministry, especially in terms of controlling corruption. So, and if they've had to resign, then there's something very, very seriously going wrong with the government of President Otto Perez Molina. And what's happened in Honduras is that the government is trying to manage the shocking revelation, even in Honduran terms, that the Social Security Institute there has been robbed of $300 million.
Ooh.
And that's just a phenomenal amount of money in a country the size of Honduras with the size of its annual budget.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too, because you've got a whole other thing going on with the president seeking to run for re-election illegally under the same conditions that his predecessor that led him into power basically kicked out the last elected president.
Yeah, Mel Zelaya was kicked out on completely spurious accusation that was heavily manipulated by the right wing and by the army, who were bought off by local big business to what most people agree was a sum of around $11 million. And Mel Zelaya was kicked out not because he was moving for re-election himself, but because he was trying to move a referendum on the Constitution over whether or not to change the constitutional rules about a president being re-elected. He wasn't pushing for re-election for himself,
right,
because he wouldn't even have been eligible, even if the referendum had passed.
Right.
But I know Juan Orlando Hernandez, the right-wing president who took power after Pepe Lobo, and the unlamented Pepe Lobo, who was the president after he took power in the what most people regard as very defective elections in whenever it was, 2009.
I love that, unlamented.
And he, in fact, he was in the news just the other day because his son was arrested in Haiti managing quite a significant drugs shipment.
Right.
So, difficult to feel sorry for Pepe Lobo, but there.
Yeah, right.
So the new president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who took over from Pepe Lobo, has, in what a lot of people, even on the right wing in Honduras, regard as an illegitimate way, he's kind of done a deal with the judicial, his mates in the judicial system, I think it got passed in the National Assembly, I'm not sure, to just reform the Constitution in that way and not without having a full-blown referendum. It's all, I'm not up on Honduran constitutional law, but a lot of people in Honduras, both and right across the political spectrum, regard that as an illegitimate way of enabling Juan Orlando Hernandez to run for re-election himself, which is very different to the situation in which Manuel Zelaya was working.
Yeah.
So, and what Juan Orlando Hernandez has done in relation to this enormous corruption scandal is he's tried to muddy the waters by claiming that the army or former army officers are organizing a military coup against him. And he actually, so you've got the weird situation in Honduras where former general Romeo Vasquez, who is the one the local Honduran business leaders bought off to carry out the coup against Mel Zelaya, he's now trying to defend himself from accusations of organizing a coup against Juan Orlando Hernandez, and he's encouraging the progressive and left-wing forces in Honduras to demonstrate in the streets against the president. And it is quite extraordinary.
The machinations are just like, you know, John Lennon watching the wheels go round and round. It's amazing what goes on.
and one of the interesting things for people here in Nicaragua is that despite the fact that the international media can make continual attacks against the Nicaraguan president, Daniel Ortega, often on allegations of corruption. And there's never been either no charges or formal charges of corruption against Daniel Ortega have ever been made inside or outside Nicaragua,
of course,
with whether he's been in or out of office. And yet you have the almost complete media silence in North America and Western Europe about these very, very serious corruption scandals in Guatemala and Honduras.
Right. Yeah. Instead, you'll hear about what's happening with Brazil, and they try to impute that to Rousseff, for example.
Yeah, or the really outrageous accusations that they're making against Diosdado Cabello, the president of the legislature in Venezuela.
Right.
And completely gratuitous, completely, there's not a shred of evidence that any of these reports accusing Diosdado Cabello of being involved in drugs running, narco trafficking, there's not even the beginnings of a factual basis for those kinds of accusations.
Right.
And they're not long ago, I think it was in the middle of last year, I think it was a former judge, might have been a serving judge of Venezuela, was arrested in Miami on drug charges.
Right.
But what happened in his case, and because you probably know a lot more about this issue than I do, but people looking at the United States criminal justice system find it hard to believe that in a great number of cases, that the person accused is actually making a plea based on their free will, because plea bargaining in the United States means that the criminal justice system is heavily weighted in favor of the prosecutors, and they can make all kinds of verbal threats that don't appear in the record.
Yep.
So to make an accused person submit to a plea that they otherwise wouldn't make.
Well, you know, let me tell you, it's as if there's a grammatical misconstruction when they say criminal justice system in the United States. People that are used to studying a normal society, when they hear that term, they think it's a system of justice in criminal cases. In the United States, it's a system of justice that's criminal. and that at the head end of it, it processes people like, you know, sheep at a slaughterhouse. They charge you with, you know, as much as they can load on in every type of case, whether you're protesting, they get you with resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, interfering with government administration, on top of whatever you were doing. You get those things. The sentences are, you know, this is an imprisonment-happy society. So the sentences are, you know, huge compared to what they are elsewhere in the world, and they aggregate them. So you're now looking at trying four cases in a system where the jury pool watches cop shows as their main source of entertainment and prosecutors, and taking them in front of those with heavy conviction rates at trial as a consequence of all of that. So I'm looking at like 9 years time for protesting, basically, or if I plead out and do 30 days and absolve the government of any liability for wrongfully arresting me and take a conviction on the chin, then I'm out. And that's what happens.
Yeah, and that is what seems to have happened in the case with this Venezuelan official, an official from the Venezuelan justice system, and he originally pleaded not guilty, and then very shortly afterwards he pleaded guilty on lesser charges, but mainly, presumably, to avoid spending a lifetime in jail.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm so that the accusers, the accusations that have been built up against somebody like Diosdado Cabello is completely, and he's beyond that kind of involvement in in any kind of petty crime like that.
They don't roll that way.
He's a really outstanding politician with a completely unblemished record.
As a matter of fact, if he could be bought off, he wouldn't be an enemy of the United States.
Well, right, exactly. So I mean, that whole campaign is part of a campaign. It's very much part and parcel, isn't it, of the campaign against, as you said earlier, against Dilma Rousseff, where they're trying to manipulate the corruption scandals in the state oil company Petrobras and the accusations against Christina Kirchner, for example.
Right.
It's not unusual to read in the financial blogs and completely baseless accusations trying to involve Christina Kirchner in internal corruption, alleged corruption scandals.
Yeah, and you know what they seem to not cover, however, are the billion-dollar deals that she's cutting with China and Russia. That doesn't make financial pages, does it?
Yeah. So I'm talking about that, of course. The big event over the last few days has been the visit by Chinese Prime Minister Li to...
Yeah.
I think he started off in Brazil, didn't he? And announced some incredible sums of money, something like $30 billion worth of funds for various investment projects. He's currently in Colombia. He's heading for Peru. And I think his last visit will be to Mexico.
Right.
Now, China already has a free trade agreement with Chile.
Right.
I'm not sure the status of their trade relations with Peru. Mm. But the interesting thing about those three countries, Colombia, Peru, and Mexico, is that they're countries that the United States is trying to corral into the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Right, and that's tracking, that tracked through this. I think they have the votes in the Senate now for that. So, for that accelerated, keep it quiet
fast
behind
track,
the whole bit. And so Li is there basically starting to negotiate, as he's bidding, basically, I'm assuming, against the United States. These are the benefits your country will have if you do business with us instead of those people.
Well, and let's see. And what I'm, it may well be that he's saying to them, you do what you like with the TPP, and if you do go along with the
right.
TPP, you may find certain limitations
right.
in terms of your trade with China because the United States is deliberately squeezing us out.
Right.
Think about that. And while we're talking about it, here's an offer of billions and billions of dollars for infrastructure and industry, and see you later,
Right, or even terms, suggesting terms for them to suggest, let's say, China's afraid of some sort of leakage of its own products back into its country with subsidies from the West to compete with it, whatever, that kind of stuff. Would you try inserting this clause and that clause, and then we don't care if you sign the TPP?
Yeah, exactly. So, there's all that kind of horse trading going on, but I just thought it was very, very interesting that at this particular moment, when, as you say, the Obama administration is mobilizing its legislative bribery machinery, bribery and corruption machinery, to get the Senate and the House of Representatives to approve the fast track, which means that the TPP will not be subject to any kind of democratic supervision or control.
You know what's interesting, too? There was a piece, I don't know if you saw this, with Marcy Kupter. She's a representative from Ohio in the House of Representatives. And she was photographed on her way into or setting up the appointment from her office to go to the basement archive where the draft of the treaty is kept that members of Congress can inspect. But they can't bring recording devices, photography equipment, they can't have copies, and they can't even bring a notepad. They are supposed to go in and look at this massive treaty without their staff and contemplate it and then, make recommendations later without even being able to take notes.
Well, I think you should be very, very appreciative that she's even allowed to look at it. And that's one of the great virtues of U.S. democracy, that legislators can look at the sheets of paper on which future legislation is written, but they can't have a copy.
You know, compare that to a place like Cuba, where people's committees develop the legislation and send it through, and they watch the meetings where it's discussed and participate, and et cetera, et cetera. And then they get to vote on it.
Oh, yeah, but that's a dictatorship, isn't it?
Right,
can't
yeah, right.
Have that.
So,
so you know, I know, sarcasm and irony aside, and it is that whole issue is something that China is very alert to, and even though the people of the United States don't seem to be alert to it, and the Chinese government is working with its trade partners, because Colombia and Peru and Mexico are very important trade partners for China, I think, and China is Mexico's second trade partner after the United States, despite the fact that Mexico is a member of the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Right.
And it's very significant that President Lee is making this visit right now.
Well, Peru especially, by the way, China's going to build. That's one of the things that they announced and firmed up, I guess, in Brazil, is actually going to build that transcontinental railroad, and it's going to go from Peru, to the Atlantic coast in Brazil. So I'm assuming China's developing that because it plans to trade using it to ship goods around, and if the relationship with Peru isn't correct. Why invest, how many hundreds of billions of dollars it costs to build that if you can't use it, if actually your competitors are using it.
Right, and the other thing, that's very relevant in the case of Peru and in the case of Colombia. And Lee, in his public statements following his meeting with President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, he made it very clear that China is prepared to build up Colombia's port infrastructure, and that's very relevant in terms of China's investment in the Nicaraguan Canal.
Absolutely.
And because I think Russia and China are investing very much in the Mariel port in Cuba.
Yes.
And they'll also be investing in port infrastructure in the rest of the Caribbean. But it's easy to forget that Colombia is very much a Caribbean country. And if they're going to benefit from the trade advantage that the Nicaraguan Canal will give countries in the Caribbean, and it's important for them also to invest in their Caribbean port infrastructure, and that's something that Lee very much puts on the table.
Yeah, and I think, that the break between Dos Santos and Uribe over negotiations with the FARC sort of is symbolic of the economic implications of which direction do we follow.
Yeah, and that issue of the civil war and the China in President Lee's statements following his meeting with Juan Manuel Santos, they stated that China would make a contribution of many millions of dollars to post-civil war reconstruction, post-civil war reorganization. And so China's very clearly supportive of Juan Manuel Santos's peace negotiations, and his visit will be, I should imagine, in domestic Colombian political terms, it'll be a huge boost to Juan Manuel Santos and boost his position vis-a-vis Uribe's resistance to the peace process.
For sure. Money talks.
The other news here over the next couple of days, I think it's today's the 22nd, right?
Yes.
So tomorrow. Tomorrow will be the beatification of Bishop Oscar Romero, who was gunned down by U.S.-funded paramilitaries, I think it was 1981. Am I right in that date?
Yeah, that's about right. It was early Reagan administration.
Yeah, and so Roberto d'Aubuisson, who subsequently became the U.S. political favorite, who was known as Blowtorch Bob for his torture practices against political opposition to the Salvadoran government at the time. And he himself, and I don't think I'm incorrect in saying that he himself admitted his involvement in the murder of Oscar Romero, who he regarded as a communist and who deserved to be eliminated.
Right. He certainly was a political opponent, for sure, and he certainly benefited from the cardinal's execution, although not in the long term, I guess.
Yeah, so now Bishop Oscar Romero is going to be the beneficiary of this beatification process, and that's very, very popular in El Salvador and the whole region, not just Central America, but the whole of Latin America. And Oscar Romero was a symbol throughout Latin America. And that legacy, that this kind of recognition of that legacy is something that has been in the news over the last week as well in Argentina in relation to... Sorry, Don. In relation to the dirty war in Argentina, in which 30,000 people were killed by the Argentinian military. And this week, President Cristina Kirchner opened a museum to commemorate that dreadful period in Argentina's history between 1976 and 1983. When she opened that center, that commemoration center, in a notorious torture building of the Argentinian Navy, the Argentinian Navy's engineering school, known as the ESMA in Argentina, and she made a very moving speech to insist that Argentina, more than anything, honor the memory of all those people that were tortured and killed at the ESMA, and by respecting human rights now, and making Argentina a beacon for human rights in the world. And that was, it was a very moving speech. And it's so easy to forget those dreadful periods, but the very forces that were responsible for those horrific events. And in the ESMA torture center, and at I think the historians agree that around 5,000 people were processed through there, and only 150 survived. And many people were shot by firing squad. Many people were taken out in helicopters and thrown out of helicopters over the South Atlantic.
Yeah, these are the same people that the United States backs, or their heirs now.
I'm backed by Henry Kissinger, backed by Vernon Walters, backed by Gene Kirkpatrick, backed by that whole general, John Negroponte, Robert Zelick was, he was part of the, who's now the president, I think he's still the president of the World Bank, I might be wrong about that, he was until recently. Yeah. But that whole generation of U.S. diplomats were part of that, they were accomplices to it.
And engineers in many ways. We got to stop there because we're out of time, but... we'll talk to you again next week, and thank you, as usual. Always very, very enjoyable to speak with you.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. So have a good week.
You too, my brother. Bye. And we'll close with John Lennon's Watching the Wheels.
People say I'm crazy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.